everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Christy Ellis. Good to be with you lovely people this morning. Happy Saturday. Can't think of anywhere I'd rather be with you fine people. And I mean that. You are my people. And I'm at my best when I'm with you. And I appreciate your example because I don't know how to live sober. But you do. And we do it together. I have a sobriety date. It's April 12, 1988. I have a sponsor. I call her my tour guide. And I talked to her earlier this week. I want to be like her when I grow up. I believe in sponsorship. And I have the privilege of sponsoring women, and gosh knows that is such a privilege. I have a lot of great women in my life, and it was already expressed, and to teach me so much about me. And it's just an amazing, amazing experience to me. And I have a home group called the Awakenings Group. We meet on Sunday mornings at 9:30. It's an open speaker meeting. We even have babysitting, so there are no excuses not to come. And even though there wasn't babysitting when I got sober, I just took my kids. They sat in the corner and colored, you know. But we are excited that we can offer that. We even have single dads coming and bringing their kids. So it's really cool to be able to, you know, offer that and have them come in. And even the kids get to know each other. That's what this thing's all about. It's about, you know, getting to know each other and introducing folks in my life to my life, you know, my kids. You know, they know you because they were raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful. Thank you to invite me to share my experience, strength, and hope here today. I'm always humbled by it. I don't care how long I've been here. I'm just a girl that got here in 1988, was dying of alcoholism, and thank God there was a way out of that hell I never thought I'd get out of, plain and simple. You know, eyeball to eyeball, we're just on this level playing field, and we're doing this deal one day at a time, helping others, helping God's kids, getting suited up so we can, you know, because that's what this thing's about. And I was a desperate girl. That was actually a gift when I got here that I was so desperate because I didn't have any mental defenses about what y'all did, you know. And I am one of those people that has one white chip, but I did all my relapsing before I got here. And that's what I tell people because they're like, you just got one. I'm like, yeah, but I did all that stuff before I got here. I just didn't hear about AA until it was time for me to hear about AA, you know, and that's, you know, we all have our own experience with that, and that's mine. And I'm 54 years old, so you don't have to try to calculate that. I always think, you know, I always do that. I'll say, I wonder how old she is, you know. Proud to be 54 and be 55 next month. And if God willing, I'll be 24 years sober, which still shocks me. I'm like, wow, because again, it's a big deal to me. But so what? You know, it's another day, living sober. One day at a time we do this stuff, and a day becomes weeks and months and then years, one day at a time, plain and simple. And that's what you told me when I got here, and I needed that. I needed to break things down because I always looked at life so big that I wasn't going to do anything because I get overwhelmed easily. You know, I'd be like, forget it. I'll never get all that done. I'm not doing it. I'd rather sit here and drink and hate my life and be paralyzed by fear. And that's what it was at the end, you know, but it wasn't all bad or I wouldn't have kept drinking, but I'm a girl that comes from a good family. I'm one of these people that had it all, that had a, you know, beautiful parents, great examples, values, the morals, the whole nine yards, eat dinner every day at 5:30, help with the dishes, can't go out unless you clean your room on Saturday morning kind of stuff. Hated that stuff. It's called discipline and structure, and I didn't like it. You know, I rebelled against it naturally. Before I took a drink, I can even remember looking back, you know, I'm the oldest of four, I'm the only girl, and I'm actually the only one that gave him a lot of trouble, but I'm grateful for when I, you know, grew up. I was a teenager in the early 70s, and that was fun. I tell you right now, I still love that music and all that peace, love, dove stuff, but minus the drinking and all the other stuff, because I didn't know where it was going to take me, but it was fun. But before I even took a drink, you know, I had that, you know, I feel like I'm on the outside looking in stuff. I lived in fantasy a lot. I loved to read. I loved to personalize the stories and pretend they were happening to me. Played Barbies till I was 12. Hate to admit that, but I did. And I loved to choreograph Barbie's life and Ken and all that stuff. And figure, you know, how this, I'm a romantic by heart. I love romance. I'm an idealist. You know, I like to look, and actually that helps. I mean, I try to look at the life, you know, sometimes too rose-colored, but, you know, really just try to look at the best in everything. When I got sober, I realized, you know, one of my examples in my life was my grandfather. He was always in a good mood, and I realized I was blessed with that, kind of that upbeat personality, and I appreciate that, and I'm excited that I got that from him. You know, that's one thing recovery's given me is I can look back and appreciate the people that have been in my life, you know, what they gave me, and I'm proud to say that, you know, I got that from him, and I'm grateful for that attitude. you know. But I didn't have that when I first, you know, when I first got here, because of course I was beaten down and empty. But I was, you know, I was pretty much had a lot of friends, a lot of people around me. Of course, I always felt alone because I was always thinking. I'm really big. I was always worried about being included. You know, it was huge for me. The alcoholic mind to me, let's always talk about this, because before I even took a drink, you know, I was thinking this way. You know, the alcoholic mind is always going, and what are they thinking about me, and do they like me, and I wonder if they'll pick me. And my mind was so consumed with being included that even when I was, I didn't know it. You know, I would be just so consumed, you know, and that happens a lot. It happened a whole lot. There were a lot of things I wanted in my life, and I didn't even realize I already had them. Till they were gone, because I was so worried thinking about them and keeping them, and I didn't know how to handle it anyway when I did have it. Because my mind, the alcoholic mind, is so powerful, and it will tell me things that just aren't true, you know, and I believe them. My alcoholism was huge. You know, today I'm happy to say my sponsor's louder than my head, and I need that. You know, you guys are louder than my head, but that's not the way it was before I took a drink. Insecure kid, good family, God in my life, going to church, joining everything, because I thought if I was this, then it would mean something. I don't know where that. I don't even know where any of this thinking came from. And that's alcoholism, because I had the best of everything. I had this whole nice life and these good role models, and they did the social drinking, and I'm so self-centered, I wasn't worried about what they were doing. You know, I'm not worried about what other people are doing. You know, I'm worried about me, you know, and how I feel, and if you're going to like me, and what's going to happen if I do this, that, and the other. And so until I was, you know, 14 years old, I was, you know, just on the outside looking in, living through books, living in fantasy land. But when I hit about 12, I started changing. And, you know, we do, puberty. I think it started changing. And I started the rock and roll. I started getting real attracted to that, and the crazy dressing and the earrings that I had to have my ears re-pierced. We wore so much heavy earrings. I'm surprised I don't have neck problems from that. You know, just the jewelry that we used to wear, and just cramming a million bracelets and the rings and just the whole sitting around the flagpole at school chanting and just all that stuff. I loved it. Adrenaline. I was attracted to anything that would get me out of the way I felt, you know, and I was like, wow, I just want to be like them. And so I did everything they did. And I'm a leader, but yet I can be a follower, too, if I see something. And then all of a sudden, then I'll become the leader, because I'm good at getting up front, you know. I got to get up front, because I thought that defined me, you know. And I thought position and what I had defined me, and the way I dressed defined me, and everything on the outside defined me. And even though I had God in my life, in my head, I never didn't believe in Him. That wasn't enough for me. You know, I'd go to youth group, but I didn't really go to youth group. I'm sure some of y'all did that. We'd sneak out and go meet guys, you know, because when I hit 12, 13 years old, men became, or guys, I shouldn't say men, they're boys, you know, became very attractive to me. And for some reason, I thought that I had to have them in my life all the time. And I thought I had to be distracted by them, and I had to be thinking about them, and they defined who I was, and if I had a whole bunch of them like me, then I must be really something, and all that. And I call that the God-shaped hole stuff. You know, I had a God-shaped hole inside of me, and I was always trying to fill it with anything but God. People, situations, alcohol enhancers, that's what I call enhancing that alcohol, because back then it was, you know. But when I took my first drink at 14, I was with a girl, and my mom and dad had thrown us in, put in private school, and she lived in town in this big old house, and we walked up to this. This is when it was safe to walk up to a grocery store and ask somebody to buy some Boone's Farm. I don't know why I picked that. Nasty stuff. I never drank it again, but that was my first drink. And I don't know that I didn't dance on tables. I didn't do anything crazy. Couple things. It was attractive because I wasn't supposed to be doing it. I remember her dad talking to us about it, but what it did, something switched inside of me. And, you know, it made me feel good enough where I was like, I like this. Because, again, I like to get out how I feel. The ways I had done it prior to that was, like in fourth grade, my cousin said, if you put an aspirin in a Coke, it'll make you feel different. And I was like, cool, let's do it. You know, or pajama parties, and some of the girls will probably remember this, fainting each other, you know, hyperventilating, which is sad because today kids are dying doing that. But we would do that just to make ourselves feel different. Or we'd say, let's act like drunk people and spin around in the front yard and just get really dizzy and fall everywhere. And we just laugh. And I'm like, wow. Little did I know, years later, I would really be doing that and not really laughing. But please stop spinning, bed, you know, and better drink some more to get those spins to go away. But so I took my first drink at 14, and something switched, and so my high school years were really full of finding the parties, getting to know everybody. I'm very social. When I want something, I'm good at fitting in. Alcohol gave me that ability. The alcohol enhancers gave me that ability. It was just a connection. I was looking for a connection. You know, because I never felt connected to me, you, or God. I realized that when I got sober. I always felt this disconnect. And so what I was trying to do was connect in. I want to feel like I'm where I'm at. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. I don't want to be worried about what I'm going to be doing later or what I was doing. Never knew how to be in the moment. Never knew how to enjoy it. I was always looking ahead. When I started drinking, I really started looking ahead because then I would be calculating saving alcohol for later. You know, and I noticed that, and inventory is so great when we get sober because it really helped me look back at the truth of my condition even that early, you know, in my life. And the way I thought and felt and drank, which is our connector, you know, that language of the heart stuff, you know, that connects it. The drunken me sees the drunken you thing, you know. And that's why it's so important that we share these stories, because the identification is why I stayed the first time I came to a meeting. Because I heard people talking about me and I didn't even know their names. And it brought me to tears, and I had never had that experience before. I thought I was the only one. And that's what we pass on, is that hope. That's the hopeless to hopeful stuff. And so that stuff, even in high school, I can remember doing that and trying to finagle things. And my friends, you know, there's a couple of, you know, things that, you know, I looked at and I saw. I remember we'd get together and we'd have an hour to drink. And they'd say, let's get a six-pack. It'd be four of us. And I'd say, are you kidding? We need a case. Because I'm already calculating. A six-pack ain't doing jack. Unless y'all plan on getting something else. Because that's mine, you know. And I get selfish. You know, my default position is selfish. You know, I thought I was this really loving person, but I had a rope attached to everything I did. If I ain't getting something out of it, well, sorry. You know, I really don't mean to be ugly, but I'll apologize later kind of stuff. You know, so that, or I'd say I'll do something like the wimpy thing. If you give me the hamburger today, I'll pay you Tuesday stuff. Probably you younger people, I don't know if you know who Popeye and Wimpy were, but the older people do. And it was that kind of thinking and just that whole, and all that did to me was create loose ends inside of me, like little piranha is what I call them. That started, you know, when I let people down, when I did something embarrassing, you know, when I didn't feel like I was included, I didn't feel a part of it. Just takes a split second for me not to feel like I'm a part of something. Split second. You know, even in recovery that can happen. You know, I think that, you know, that's just part of the way we're made. We're wired like that. Just takes a second to feel like I don't belong here. You know, and I hate that feeling. And y'all know, I don't care how long we're sober. I accept that's part of my alcoholism. But we know what to do if that happens. You know, and that's that whole connected in thing. And I used to think it was the world. You know, the book talks about the problems of air making. It was me. You know, I remember when I first got sober and telling my sponsor that, man, I am amazed at how everybody's changed in my life. You know, my family's different and everybody's looking at me different. And she's like grinning. I said, what? She said, it's you, not them. It's you. You've changed. We start, you know, the new pair of glasses thing. But back then, even in high school, I had that stuff, you know, that thinking. And I think it's important to talk about that because I didn't know I had that thinking until I got in recovery and started, you know, I did inventory and I really talked with other folks, like-minded people, and talked about that stuff. And so I was good at throwing my family in tailspins because of my self-centeredness. Frequently, my family would be in the car waiting to leave and go somewhere and I'm still up in my room getting ready. You know, I'm good at, you know, that makes me feel important, you know, and that's so arrogant, you know, and I didn't think of it then. I just thought, I'm the oldest girl, I'm a teenager, and we need to, you know, I can make an excuse for any behavior I have, and I did that. But my family, I got to give it to my parents, never ever, they were always consistent. There was always love. They were always there. I took full advantage of it. I did. And the good news is I was able to make amends for it and have still do today by being a good daughter. But I really was like, even in the teenage years, throwing everybody in a tailspin. The last minute I decided I wanted to go to college. Straightened up in my senior year. I'd gotten in a bunch of trouble. And it's pretty bad when the principal comes up to you and says, I really seem like you're straightening your life out a little bit, you know. And it's like, you don't want to even be seen talking to the principal. You know that. It's not cool. And you're like, okay, walking away. You know, I don't want him recognizing me. You know, even when we did the sitting around the flagpole stuff in eighth grade, They called my parents. They walk out and get me out, pull me out in front of everybody. And then I went back, of course, because that's what we do. But it's like I never got away with anything, but I didn't stop doing it either. You know, I was just like, okay, and then I just keep on doing it. You know, I'm going to do what I want to do when I want to do it because that's how I think. And it's more important to me that I'm okay. And that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean anything. It just means I'm not okay in my own skin. It just means that I don't feel good about me and I want to feel better, and so I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get there. Alcohol was the vehicle. I went to college at the last minute. I applied and, of course, threw them in a tailspin, and I went on my parents' scholarship. I heard someone say that, and my parents paid for me to go. And it was my parents' scholarship. I mean, and I didn't care that they paid. I went, and all I could think about is meeting as many guys as I could, but more importantly, where's the student center so I can drink? And that's when my drinking really changed. I didn't have anybody, I didn't have any sneaking in I had to do, I had anybody monitoring what I was doing. Because all through my teenage years, you know, there's that sneaking in and that hiding and the pretending and the lying and all that stuff just with a little piranha eating up my soul, making me feel bad about myself. I didn't know that's what was happening, but that's what was happening. It's making me feel bad about myself. You know, and one thing I'd like to mention, you know, I've always been drawn to helping others anyway. And when I was a teenager, I worked at camps and I helped underprivileged kids and things like that. And I love helping people. That's just kind of something I've always enjoyed. And the more I drank, when I started drinking at 14, by the time I was 16 or 17, I wasn't interested in doing that stuff. I just had to focus on drinking and partying. We're going to party. That's what we used to always say, go and party and let's go party. Let's go party. And it was about getting drunk. You know, it was about the effect. It was about, you know, getting that place that I want to be and having fun and laughing continuously and all that. But the problem is I didn't stay there, you know. And then, you know, the blackout drinking started when I was in college. I met some folks, like-minded people, because we find each other. We find each other. And I did. I found some folks that drank like I did, liked to party. I had 8 o'clock classes that I shudder to think of what I looked like when I went to some of them. And I said when I went because I didn't go frequently. And I think they do that purposely to freshmen. I went to Radford. It was college then. It's university now. And tech was 30 minutes away, which all of these were factors in me taking out the school. You know, it was a party school and there were guys nearby. And so I've got the ingredients. I've got those two things. Never mind. It's just to go there and learn. And I wanted to be a teacher. Again, all that stuff becomes way back here when I start drinking. Because I started having fun and filling up the God-shaped hole, and who are these new people? I was very fickle with who I liked. I did not like the nice guys. I know there's some, you know, I didn't want anybody that was boring. I wanted the long-haired guy with no license and no job and sitting around smoking a bong and just, he's my kind of guy. You know, those are the kind of guys I like. And I love that. I was very drawn to that. And I really embarrassed myself a lot in college with some things that happened to me. Because when I start drinking, I can't stop. I even tried to try to control grain. And that's crazy. I mean, come on. And I'm 18 years old at grain parties trying to think, if I just drink it, really calculating it, you know, it doesn't work. We all know that. But it was just, you know, and so what happened during that, my little 6 months in college, it was the biggest party I ever went to. That's what I always say. It was just a big old party. And I really drank a lot. That daily drinking, pretty much. And my mom was smart. She wouldn't send me a lot of money. And so I would be always promising and borrowing and, once again, creating more loose ends inside of me, making me feel bad about myself, not knowing that's what it is, but that's unresolved stuff. It was eating me alive without me knowing it, you know. And I started doing things I wasn't proud of, started waking up in places that I don't know how I got there with people I didn't know and all that stuff that happens, you know. The things that make sense when I'm drunk that are totally insane when I'm sober. And then stuff that I would do that I used to think were, you know, when I was drinking, they made sense when I was sober too. I mean, my thinking eventually got there. But alcohol really made me look at life different, and alcoholism does, because the drinking is just a symptom. You know, I was drinking, but my thinking was really screwed up, and the God-shaped hole just got bigger and bigger, and I got emptier and emptier. Felt worse about myself, wouldn't really look in the eyes so much. And again, you know, they asked me to leave, which they should. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. You know, I want a free ticket. You know, I'm like, you know, I used to wanted to get a pat on the back for working 8 hours at my job that they're paying me to do. I don't know. It's that entitlement stuff, you know, and it's that, well, you just don't understand. You know, well, you're right, they didn't, because they weren't like me. And I was good at playing the victim, too. I had the T-shirt and the hat and the whole nine yards, because I love people to feel sorry for me. It did give me power. And it did justify a lot of my behavior, especially when I had children. So, I was leaving something with an aspiration, I'm going to go back one day. I'm going to go back, and, you know, I'm going to go back one day, but right now I need to go home. But I knew I couldn't live in that house. It's a very structured household. My mom is awesome, runs a tight ship, though. And I knew, I had enough info. I believe God has always been giving me the information my whole life about everything. I just don't pay attention to it until I got in recovery. And even then, I got to make sure I pay attention, because he uses a lot of ways to give me that info. And that's basing stuff on truth, you know, but I'm good at basing it on Christie's head, delusion, and what I want, you know, and it's that Christie created crisis stuff, you know. And so I'm good at that, and I'm comfortable in that, because I know it's going to happen, even if it's not good for me. Because, see, I didn't have any faith. Even though I had God in my life, I had long ago stopped turning to him. I didn't have any faith. I didn't know that until I got sober. That was the deal. It wasn't about that I believe in God. I didn't have any faith. You know, I was so worried about the outcome that I never would do anything unless I knew what was going to happen. So I came home. I got an apartment with that friend in high school. We all have them. And it lasted 6 weeks. You know, and of course it was all her fault. She was doing all this bad behavior, you know, and of course it wasn't. You know, I'm bringing streamloads of people in and all, but the only thing I focused on is what she was doing to me, you know, and that's why I like the resentment stuff in the fourth, you know, in the fourth step, because it talks about take them out of the equation, because if that wasn't taken out of the equation, there's a lot that I wouldn't really look at. It doesn't matter what other people are doing. It's what I do that matters. And so I came home, moved in with her. And I'm an extreme girl. I like to push the envelope. I like to do everything to the nth degree. So I don't, you know, of course I said she was bothering me. She said I was bothering her. So we had to go in front of a judge and sign a paper saying we wouldn't talk to each other for 7 years, which is weird. I don't even know where that came from. It's weird. That is so weird. I don't even know what that seven-year thing signifies. But we did it. I did it. I was like, you know, but I'm feeling so inferior about myself because, again, I can feel not a part of very easily. I can feel insecure very easily. I can feel very inferior very easily. Even on the outside looking in, I look like I got it all together. You know, I'm living a good life. I'm living in my own apartment. I have my own car that my parents carry on their insurance. You know, it's that whole, you know, I look good. I was good at looking good. But behind the scenes, it wasn't quite that way. And my parents didn't know a lot of that stuff that was going on, or they wouldn't have been supporting it, I'm sure, or supported it as long. So anyway, I moved out and moved in with my cousin. Here's my selfish self again, who was getting a divorce. How convenient for me. I got somewhere I can go live. See, I'm not even thinking about her getting a divorce. I'm thinking about me. Good answer. I can go live with my cousin. So I did. And that's where my bar drinking started. You know, every time I did something different levels, different avenues of drinking. It never crossed my mind not to. I'm not a social drinker. It doesn't make sense to me to drink a couple. I'm like, waste of time, you know. And my mother grew up in an alcoholic home, so she was one of these people that would just let it melt down. And I would say, I didn't even wonder then, why are you wasting that alcohol? Yeah, I don't get it. You know, that's before I even took a drink. So, she just grew up in an alcoholic home and did not... didn't want to be around it. None of them drank. It's crazy. It's like it skipped a generation, and all the cousins, we all found each other, you know, and it skipped them, and we've had some times. But and sadly, I'm the only one that's in recovery. So I really, you know, I feel blessed and grateful because there, for the grace of God, go I. That, you know, one of them found dead in his apartment. Another one's still out there, and another one just died a year ago, found dead. And I had tried and had come back into my life. I had tried to help and. You know, again, there for the grace of God, go I. And that's why it's one day at a time, you know. And so I moved, you know, in her, and it's party hardy and go to the Fannies. I don't know if any of y'all remember Fannies. And got to know the bartenders and started doing real crazy stuff, like bringing whole bands home, didn't even know the people, you know. And it made sense at the time, okay. And one of the guys was cute. Okay, there's a cute guy involved. I'm there. And so, but drinking made it seem like it made sense. And they were from New York. I mean, I put myself in these crazy situations and then go home and pass out. And then wake up with that, oh my God, what happened? Who are these people? You know what we go through, you know. And then, or waking up and there's food cooked all in the kitchen and the oven's still on and you've made this huge breakfast and your head's just laying down like that. And it's like, I did it again. You know, and it's that eating, that drunk eating, Jack in the Box burritos at 7 in the morning. Y'all remember that stuff? Yeah. Woohoo, good nutrition. But it had to soak up that alcohol, you know, and going to concerts and like being, really, it was cool as a teenager to go to concerts because you could drink anything past to you or do anything else past to you and you weren't going to die or jump off the building or anything. It was all that peace, love, dove, good partying. So it was different. But anyway, listen to me, defending when I grew up. But it was fun. But anyway, so I did the bar drinking and I did, you know, going. I ended up going by myself. Excuse me, I'd go in by myself. I didn't need to know anybody, you know, I was already painting myself in a corner, isolating myself. You know, people didn't really know me. I'm good at pretending I'm like this great person. Like I said, I want to know all about you. I'm not telling you anything about me. Because I got to tell you the truth, I couldn't have put words to me if I tried. When I was younger, I used to write poetry a lot. When I was 12 and 13, 14, I used to like to write. I still like to write. And really enjoyed that creative writing stuff. Once again, that's another thing, you know, working with the kids, or, you know, people that need extra is what I call it, writing, reading, things that I loved took a back seat. The only thing I focused on was drinking and getting through the day. I'm already waking up and being really sick and shaken and drinking bottles of Maalox and just thinking about my family, you know, and I lived enough away where they didn't really know what was going on. One night I wrecked my car. It was weird. I still can't figure this out, and I really haven't spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, but you could only make right turns, and I got it home somehow, and then I had to explain it to my parents. And you know, I used to think that stuff made sense when I talked to them. They didn't believe that stuff. They did. I mean, you know, I'm the only one that believed it, you know, and Mom and Dad, you know, that's when I really looked back and had to really look honestly at it and think, wow, they just hung in, you know, and praying that it's really not going on. And I've been there. One of my sons went through something from 12 to 16, and I've been there. It's hard. Even having all the information I have and being that person, it's tough. It's tough to be there, you know, and it made me really look at, wow, what I had really put my family through. And so this began my thinking, you know, and so what I decided, listen to me, I decided what I needed to do was get married and have kids. And that's the alcoholic solution. We know that. And I always laugh because, you know, I used to go on relationships. I didn't go out on dates. We get together, we're together. And they have that joke about, you know, what's an alcoholic take on a first date? A U-Haul, you know, and it's like, I like that. But I understand that. I get that. I get that. Really do. I even did that in junior high school. You know, even I was like thinking of what my name would sound like with his last name, Mrs. blah, blah. And I'm 14, you know, it's crazy. But I thought, I need to get married. My parents have a good life. Maybe I can have it. Once again, outside stuff want to make inside feel better. So I met this guy, and here, God giving me all the info, a guy that I had known in junior high school. We called it junior high. It wasn't middle school. And so that's what I'm talking about if, you know, everybody's going junior high. But he was kicked out of the school system. And that's information. But I like that, remember. I'm attracted to that stuff. Anyway, we met. He was in the Army. I'm running up down the road going to Fort Monroe. We're partying. He's got a van. He lent it to me one time, and I just thought he loved me so much because he lent me that van. And I just thought I was something. And it was, you know, and I'd stay home maybe one night a week, but I was usually the one calling. You know, every morning I'd get up and say, oh, I'm going to stay home tonight. 5 o'clock, I'm on the phone getting everybody together, rallying the troops. And I'd eat a piece of cheese to make myself feel like I was getting some nutrition, you know, it's that kind of thing. And so, but I smoked cigarettes and drank, plain and simple. So, just to fast forward a little, you know, had that relationship, got a lot of info that I really didn't need to do it, but we ended up getting married anyway. Because I knew that was the solution. I knew that. And I mean, a lot of strong info. Like, he's in the Army in Germany, and his captain calls and says, you might not want to marry him because he's in trouble. That's big. But that's the length, that's the depth of no, I know what's best for me more than you do was. Nope, I'm marrying him anyway. We'll just reorder the invitations. And my mama did, and we got married. And we were married 5.5 years. I was 21 years old. And I thought that was going to change my life, and it did. It did change my life. It changed my life. I didn't even know him, really. I mean, we drank all the time together. When people aren't drinking, they're different. And he loved smoke pot. Loved it. Like it was just, he loved it. I think he loved it more than me. And that's fine. But I still am a romantic, I'm idealist, and so I'm drinking. But then I got pregnant, and I had a baby at 22, 23, and 25. I had a girl and then two boys. And every time I got pregnant, I stopped. I'm happy to report. Stop smoking, stop drinking. But I'd always go back to it. And after the third baby, little boy, sweet little boy, things have not been good. And which is not a big surprise when you think about it. I think we were doing the best we could with what we had. We were young. I look at my kids now because they're 32, almost 31, almost 29. And I'm like, wow. When I looked at them at that age and went, oh, my God. What I was living was unbelievable. And what my parents, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, but these kids were so young. And by the time I was 26, we were splitting up. It was 4, 3, and 1 is their ages. And I was always looking for people to justify my drinking. So I had certain friends that wouldn't call attention to what I was doing. And I didn't have to work after I had the second one because it would cost too much money. So I was at home a lot. And I was telling my pediatrician one time how it was just terrible at home. It just really gotten bad. He gets kind of violent when he drinks. And I remember just telling him to buy the pot to keep the peace, you know. And I didn't care. I was drinking my wine and my whatever my friends brought over and just get the kids into bed and drink. And I went to the pediatrician. The pediatrician's like, the deal is to drink a glass of wine at 4 o'clock before he gets there. And I'll just take the edge off. Now, the average drinker, the normal drinker, would say, yeah, you know, that probably would. Probably like the people that drink one glass a day for their heart or some. I remember hearing that one time. I'm like, yeah, one glass. And but y'all know the story. I didn't drink a glass. I drank a bottle. And they're not the little bottles because I do everything in quantity, you know, and it's big and it's, and I drank it. And he didn't realize he was really helping me because I didn't really care if he came home or not at that point, you know. And so it did help me get through that. And so, but by the time I was 26 years old, I was very broken inside. I was very sad. I'm 26. I'm thinking, my God, I'm a romantic. And I thought, I can't even do marriage. What am I going to do? I got these three beautiful little children. I just want to be a good mom. I wasn't working, you know, so we had to sell our house and moved in an apartment. And drinking changed again. Different level every day, drinking case of beer a day, probably just morning to night, smoking cigarettes, probably weighed 30, 40 pounds less than I do now, believe it or not. And I thought I looked good. And, you know, and it's those eyes I was looking at. You know, I just was looking bad. I was sad. I was scared. Didn't know what I was going to do. It had nothing to do with me being a mama. You know, what I was doing had zero to do with me loving those kids or being a good mom. Alcoholism was bigger than all. And it was a good reason for me to drink. See, another reason for me to justify it, you know, and another, some more of that piranha-eating stuff inside of me to make me feel bad about myself. You know, the shame, the guilt, the heart, you know, what am I going to do, the drinking all the time just to get through the day. And this little girl moved in underneath us, and she was 16, and she became my babysitter, and I know God put her there. I know God did. She helped me a lot. I had to go out and drink at night. I could not be alone with myself. And during the day, I would do the best I could, taking the kids to the pool, and I made, you know, I had people, but I was always finding an excuse for somebody to come over and watch kids for a couple of hours. I started getting a taste of having to beg people to leave the lights on the phone, that kind of stuff. You know, I'm supporting myself then, and I really wasn't. I wanted him to, and of course, he didn't see it that way, so I ended up having to get a job. But, you know, during that period, you know, I'm just sinking more and more into this thing, and I'm going out at night, and I don't know if any of y'all from Richmond know Cimarron Rose. That was this big drinking spot. Meet anybody you want, no matter what. And I think I went in there, and I had sick on my head because sick attracts sick, plain and simple. And that was all I could attract at that point, you know. And so the sick in him saw the sick in me, and we commiserated. I went out on another relationship for 3.5 years. And I met that guy literally that night. And it was, everything went to a different level. I got introduced to a whole new world of stuff. I was drinking like nobody's business, and I was open to doing anything else that would help me feel better about me, because even sometimes that wasn't working. And so I started doing a whole lot of stuff and that I didn't need to be doing, taking my kids places they didn't need to be. And I started, I got involved, and I tried to be a doctor without the MD. And so I got, the DEA doesn't look kindly on you changing prescriptions and things like that. So I got in trouble. I don't normally talk about that from the podium, but a girl say that, because I always say I got arrested a couple times. And people are always like, for what? And I'm like, you know, it's really not a big secret. You know, it's just something I did, you know, because that's where I was. It wasn't, you know, that was just a totally different piece. But the bottom line, it's where my alcoholism took me. It helped anything like that make sense. If it's going to make it better, I'm going to do it. I don't care what it is. I traded my soul, plain and simple. And so just to fast forward, I would... had to move in with my, over the next few years, had this guy in my life, and that got real crazy doing that, and that relationship was really crazy. He was a very rageful kind of person. Unfortunately, my kids were around a lot of things they didn't need to be around, but I had the protection of my parents. I will have to say that I was in and out of my parents' house 4 times, and they took me in every time, you know. And I, it's probably because I had the kids, but that's okay. You know, I would have been homeless had they not done that. But they had their 3 grandkids. And my mother and father protected them from a lot that they didn't need to see. And I am fortunate that I had that, because a lot of people don't. You know, but I was really a lost soul, hating myself, in and out of a lot of jobs, left before they were going to fire me, because you always know. And I was not good at showing up. I mean, you said something about that, and I appreciate your share this morning, because, you know, you know, I'm a good starter, but I'm not a good hanger in there person. You know, I can look good for a couple weeks, and then they start wondering who the heck I am. You know, who is this girl? And wait a minute, what happened to the girl in the interview? You know, I can look good. You know, I can talk you into stuff. I'm good at talking people into stuff. You know, and I thought that was really neat that I could do that. But that was just something to get me in the door. But I'm not good at staying. I wasn't good at staying. I wasn't good at being honest. I didn't, you know, I wasn't truthful about who I was, because I didn't know who I was. All I knew was that I hated myself, and when I woke up, I thought, oh my God, I got to go through this again today. You know, and I hated it, and it got worse and worse and worse, and the hole in me was just, I was totally just an empty soul. A couple of things, and I'm going to get sober because it's my favorite part. Being a good mom to those kids was important to me, very important to me. And I mention that because, you know, they can't keep me sober. I wanted to be sober, but I couldn't do it. I was powerless, plain and simple. And I don't know when it stopped being fun. I don't know when that happened. I do know that I can remember very many times waking up and saying, I'm not going to do it today, and I would anyway. And I'd say, well, I'll stop tomorrow. Well, I'll stop tomorrow. I negotiated a lot with God if I'd talk to him at all. And my parents, again, picking up the slack. I had creditors. Only people were calling me because they wanted their money. You know, I wasn't paying my bills. I wasn't even opening my bills. I was throwing them in the trash because I wasn't paying them anyway. You know? And my alcoholic thinking was, my rent's $350. Oh, my gosh, I don't have the last $10. I can't pay it. That was my alcoholic thinking. I know y'all understand because you're laughing, and you probably did it too. But that's the way we think, you know? I just can't. Any reason to not do that so I could use that money. Because I wanted, you know, drinking and feeling like a good mama. And a couple things I would do for that is I would take my kids to Toys R Us and tell them to buy a $20 toy. And that was not for them. That was for me, for 5 minutes to feel like a good mama. And that, I was a sad girl. I was terrified it was going to be my life. And I really, it's a very dark. And I remember it like it was yesterday, and I'm glad I do. And when we share experience, strength, and hope, because that's all we have to share, it reminds me of that, and I need to always remember that's where I was, because my alcoholism will kill me, you know. And so I was, my parents, after the 4th time and of all the insanity that I was in that home, because I had a brother that was 17 eating in his room because he didn't want to be around me. The phone was always ringing. Sometimes it was my job asking my mother where her 30-year-old daughter was, why she wasn't at work. That's not cool. 30 years old, my mama's, they're calling my mom about where I'm at. You know, I mean, that's irresponsible. And, but I'm, again, you know, and then putting them through terror because that guy I was with, you know, I remember one night at the, near the very end, I call her and he was going to some episode and I call her, I could say, was mama help click? You know, my, and it's 4 a.m. You know, my parents were there in 5 minutes getting us out of there. So I say that because, you know, we all have those stories and those situations we stay in, and because I didn't think I deserved any better. You know, I didn't even know if I deserved that. All I knew is that I hated myself, I was sad, and drinking was the only thing that helped me deal with it. And what happened was my parents got fed up, and good for them. They said, you got to leave. You know, we'll watch the kids, you got to get out of here. We can't do it anymore. And that was, I thanked them when I got sober, because there were a lot of things that brought me to my knees. It wasn't just like one night I was like surrendered, you know, because it just doesn't happen like that. You know, it's like, you know, I think I'll get sober. And it just doesn't happen like, from my experience. My experience was, you know, getting arrested and being in that relationship. And just, I had people in my job coming up to me saying, you know, Christy, my husband got sober and went to St. John's Hospital and sharing me all these stories. Y'all know what they were doing. And I'm thinking, wow, that is really good. I'm really happy for them. And then I'm thinking, why are they telling me? You know, and so, but I didn't know then, but I know now why. They were doing what we do. They were sharing experience. They were planting a seed, because we don't know when anybody's going to get it. We just got to be the best we can be at all times, because we don't know when someone's going to get it. So that was going on. I'm in this job. I'm trying to do the best I can. I'm borrowing money from the people there. So then after I do that, because I can't pay it back, I can't look at them anymore, look them in the eye. Or even sometimes I go back and ask again. And they say no. And then I really feel bad about myself. So it's all that kind of behavior going on. And I felt like I was just riding in circles all the time. I'd leave and go to the store and think of 10 other things to do before I came home. So I'm gone 24 hours. They don't know where I'm at. I'm putting my family through a lot, my children through a lot. But thank God again that they protected them. But meanwhile, I'm dying of this thing. And my parents said, you got to get out of here. You know, not, they didn't say it like that. You got to get out of here. They just said, you need to leave. You know, this isn't working. And so I went to my friend, packed up all my stuff, and I drive to my friend's, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to change, and I'm going to do better, you know, because my dad is standing in the backyard crying, saying, why won't you stop, you know, what can we do? And my brother is going back to college saying, why do you keep doing that? Like, I'm choosing to be unhappy and miserable, but he didn't get it either. Another one lived somewhere else, and the other one was eating in his bedroom because he didn't want to be around me. And I'm stealing money out of his room that he's saving to be responsible for insurance. You know, so I'm hurting everybody. I'm stealing from my parents. I'm stealing checkbooks and writing checks on accounts that are closed. And police are coming and asking them about it. And they're and putting her in position of, what does she do? So all that crazy tearing through life stuff's going on. And it affected me, but it's like I pretended some other girl did it. I was really good at pretending somebody else did all that stuff. It just wasn't me. And so I left and went to my friends, drank for a week. What else am I going to do? You know, I'm thinking I'm going to go get my life together. But if I knew about solutions, wouldn't I have been doing it? I mean, and so I went, and it was good for me to do that, because it really, everybody was out of my life at that point. Only people that had to be in my life were in my life. You know, nobody wanted to be around me. I would go to a bar and drink, and I would dare people to come talk to me. I didn't want anybody talking to me. I remember finding a little piece of paper one day a few years ago. It said, get help, that I had written when I was sitting in there right before I got sober. And that was so exciting when I found that. But I was just, you know, I'm riding around going to, you know, when I was riding around, I'd watch people going to work every day, wondering what it felt like to be those people. And I would have given you $1 million for that, just to feel like I was just a normal person going to work. But, and I was terrified I would never have that. And I remember looking at my kids in my parents' kitchen, and I'm thinking, I know I love them, but I don't even feel good feelings anymore. I was just so empty. And it just broke my heart. And again, the fear was so huge. And so when my mom and dad got word to me to come back, but she said, there's only one thing, you got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know where she got that from, but I know something happened where I was willing to do something. And I had been praying more right at that, you know, God, please help me get out of this first step prayer stuff. And again, we don't know what's going to happen. And so I went to a meeting. And I didn't pick up a white chip that day, but I did go, and I sat in the back, And I don't know where she got that from. I say God whispered in her ear. You know, she said she doesn't even remember. I asked her years later. I don't know why I never asked her that until I'd been sober a while. I guess it just really didn't matter. It was just, but I did it because there was some part of me that just wanted to live, you know, because I felt like I was dying. And I went and I sat and I saw people like you that felt good in their own skin and they were bright-eyed and they were telling me to call them back. Well, that was really alien to what I'd been hearing, and they were friendly and they were glad to see me. And the biggest thing is that they actually wanted to come back, but the bigger thing was the language of the heart was going on. The hope was talked about. People were describing how they thought, drank, and felt, and I connected with that. And that's what I was talking about in the beginning. We have to connect with that or we're not going to stay. That's a level of connection, one drunk talking to another, that only happens with us. And I believed you enough to go to another meeting because I was like, wow. And I couldn't stop thinking about you. Didn't stop drinking, but I couldn't stop thinking it planted a seed. And I thought, and then, you know, alcoholism starts talking and going, nah, that was just at that meeting. It's not going to be like that at another one. And I went and I saw the same thing. And I was like, wow. And so a few weeks later, over the next few weeks, I called St. John's Hospital and answered the questions that they ask you. And, you know, they're like, you need to get over here right now. You know, so surrender's starting to happen. And I'm really, God in his mercy showed me what I really look like in a mirror at work. I looked at myself and I didn't even recognize myself. I was like, oh my God. I was getting sick constantly. I couldn't hold it together. I couldn't have conversations with people. My motor skills were even getting screwed up. Everything was screwed up. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't concentrate. It was horrible. And so April 11th, 1988, I woke up and something was different. And Bill Wilson talks about, in Language of the Heart, the greatest gift we get here is the spiritual awakening that happens to us. And that's what happened. He says in that reading, you awake or you die. And I had an awakening that morning. For some reason, I knew something was different. I don't know what it is, and it doesn't matter. Y'all know, we know God was lifting me up because Christy could not have done that. Something was different, but it's almost like I intuitively knew I only had a small window of time to do what I needed to do. So I went into my job, and I said, I'm dying. I've got to take a leave of absence, and I don't care if I lose my job. And that was surrender. That was surrender. I give up. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I called St. John's Hospital, and they said I could come that night, and my mom and dad are crying, yes. And, you know, I'm asking her, like, can you keep the kids? Like, that's something different. And so, you know how we are. You know, it's like, you sure you don't mind? You know, because all of a sudden I'm, like, aware that maybe I have been inconveniencing people a little bit and being a little entitled. And, you know, and arrogant. And so my brother that's 17 that I've been stealing from, and he got to keep my car. I know that's why he wanted to drive me out there. And he's probably, thank you, God, to get that woman out of this house. You know, I can eat in the kitchen again. I can, you know, he could be 17, be a senior in high school. And I'm closer to him than I am to any of my brothers, which is so funny. When I got sober, he just really wanted to learn about it. And he's a filmmaker, so he's done a lot of, it's really neat. So I went, and at St. John's, some of you went. I know Ross was there before I was. Ross, that's twice I've said it, Ross. I said it three times. Told him I'd say his name three times, so I've said it. And I'll say Linda, too. So I went there, and I had a very positive treatment experience. They match you up with somebody. But I can tell you the most powerful thing that happened for me was I went in that night, and the next morning when I woke up, I didn't want to drink anymore. And I know that's the power greater than myself, because only a power greater than myself could have lifted me up to help me start walking out of that hell I never thought I'd get out of. And that's what the steps are for me. They walked me out of the hell I never thought I'd get out of. And that's the way I describe them. And I can still remember, I was like, oh my God, you know, everything is so different, and I couldn't believe I didn't want to drink. And it was structured. It's what I needed. I ate three meals a day and gained 15 pounds, which I needed. I really needed to physically get better because I was very sick. And they had routines. They took us out to AA meetings. AA's brought meetings in. That's why treatment facility committees are so important. And I got to know people, and it was it was an awesome experience. At first, I felt like I was just like in a dream, you know, but I was so surrendered, I was just like, okay, which is the most spiritual word I can say. And Lydia, you talked about that too. It's just that, yes, okay. I wanted to feel like you looked. And I said, what do you do? What do you do? How do I do that? Because I got scared. Can I have it too? And yeah, you can. The highest you get here sober. I mean, it's like, if you're willing to do what we do, you can have it too. We're on a level playing field here. And they told me, get a sponsor, get a home group, you know, get involved, get in the middle of the circle and triangle, and don't get out. You know, I had some good, good folks to listen to, and tour guides. I've had a few good tour guides, my sponsors, and you. I mean, you. And I tell you, I was so grateful to feel this a little teeny bit better that I said, wow, the more I do, the better I'm going to feel. Because I know my husband always says, if you do good, you feel good stuff, and it's true. And I didn't, and I was also reminded to keep my feet on the ground that some days aren't going to be so great. And you know what? If I'm not uncomfortable, I'm not going to get better. And Angela, I would think about Angela talking about that at our meeting. One of my tree sisters is here. Glad you're here. And, you know, I was always told you got to get uncomfortable to get comfortable. And then you get uncomfortable, and then you get comfortable, and then you get different, and then it gets comfortable again. Yeah, it's just, you know, and it changes. And thank God it does, you know. And so what happened for me is I went into treatment, and I didn't want a guy in my life either, I'm happy to report. And I spent the next few years rebuilding my life with my kids. You know, I was 30. I turned 31 in treatment. I still have a little bunny they gave me. It said a little sign on it. Said, I need loving. And it's so cool. I still have it. Whenever my kids go through something, like my daughter went through a surgery, and I gave her the bunny to hold. They grew up, you know, knowing about the bunny. The bunny's very important. And they would come see me at treatment, and I could see them looking at me differently. Kids were looking at me differently, and I went home, and you know, big surprise, lost my job. I had that felony stuff hanging over my head, and of course, no credit, and so I was I would have been homeless had I not had my parents to go to, and I did, and so what I did was I just went to meetings every day, and I got to know people, and I made myself go in meetings and get 3 women's phone numbers, and I made myself call them and just say, hey, I'm practicing. You know, because I wasn't this social person that I had been earlier in life. All that had been robbed. But, you know, the transformation has happened in my life. Sure, almost 24 years into it. Yeah, I'm social. And some of those people probably want me to be quiet. And but back then I had to make myself do it. And I did. I would go to meetings, and I would get to know people, and they'd be announcing they're going to be planning some picnic, and I'd go to the committee meeting, and I'd get involved, and I'd do whatever I needed to do to hook in with Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wanted to live, because I believe to drink is to die. I know that with every part of me, and I don't want to go there. And I had an old-timer tell me, Christy, if you're willing to change, you've already started changing, and that's a pearl. Think about it. If I'm willing to change, I've already started changing. I'll take that. Just that little bit. And so I lived with my parents for a few months and got a sponsor who said, you know, we do things in order around here. You got to get a job, and then you get the apartment. So I was like, okay. So I had to get a job, and I learned about, you know, opening your car door and getting God to go with you when you go places. And I mean, I wanted to live, so I did everything very structured. Like, I did open my door and say, come on, God, go with me, and that kind of stuff, because it helped me. I read the book in the morning and at night. I got hooked into praying. You know, I hung out with the busy people. I didn't know they were the busy people. They looked like they were okay in their own skin, and they were busy doing stuff, and I wanted to be there. That's what I did. Now, you know, my feet took me there. I got involved. I made friends with women. I was not interested in having a man in my life, and I'm grateful for that, because it was enough just trying to rebuild my life with those kids. And, you know, I had a gift, had a chance to live and be that mom I always wanted to be. 8, 7, and 5 is how old they were when I got sober. And we have a great relationship, I'm happy to report. And it's some great memories. You know, they remember all those early days and them going to meetings and sitting and coloring. And they never thought I chose anything over them, because you taught me how to just do it all and not make anybody feel like, because I don't think that we get sober to just tell our family to sit over here and wait. You know, that's not this deal, you know. I mean, they're the very people I hurt, you know. And so I invited them into my life, and I talked to them about me and showed them what I was. My mother came over once a week so I could go to my home group, and I would get with other women, and we'd trade off babysitting. And after a little bit over a year sober, I had to go to court. And, you know, the transformation that happens in, you know, when we apply these steps in our life and these principles, the traditions, the concepts, all 36 of them that I've learned to apply in my life as spiritual principles to live and play with others, they do something to you. You look different. I went to court, they didn't even recognize me. The officer didn't recognize me. The pharmacist didn't recognize me. Nobody. They were like, that's you. You know, and I was like, that's the power of this thing. You know, the judge is like asking me, okay, well, tell me about what you've done. And God gave me the words, had a bunch of people in the courtroom with me because I had a bunch of years hanging over me. And I asked God to give me the words, you know, and I just said, you know, I have a disease. You know, I talked about the truth of my condition and what I'd been doing, and it's not why I got sober. I told him that. I said, it's just something I did as a result of where I was, you know. And the prosecution just said, you know what, we like her. We're pleased with her candor. She doesn't have to do anything. And I did not have probation. I had nothing. But some years later, though, I think, God reveals to us why things happen. Now, it went on my record as a felony. That's never shown up. Weirdest thing. But I always say I did it because people will be like, why'd you say you did that? And I said, because I did. The minute I start denying what I've done, I'm in trouble. But at 9 months sober in my home group, I started carrying meetings to the prison to women. And all throughout my whole recovery, I've carried meetings in the jails and the prisons. And I believe that God knew he'd use me more that way. And so that's why that probably happened. And it really doesn't matter. Bottom line is that I was willing to do it. And, you know, being in a strong home group, you get introduced to those opportunities above group level because I'm a big believer in that. I'm a service girl. I see some of my service buddies here. I just love it. I was like, ooh, service people. And going to see them at the assembly in a few weeks. And it's just... But anyway, I've just got a couple minutes, and, you know, I still break the rules. We climbed over the chairs and went back there and prayed. But I have to get prayed up because I don't want to do the talking. I don't know what you'll get. It might be the same thing, but I'm not taking a chance. I want God to use me and say what needs to be said the way that he wants it to be said because he knows who needs to hear what out here. All I know is that I've made the most of my years. It doesn't mean it's always been a piece of cake. Doesn't mean I haven't had adversity. Doesn't mean that I haven't had things go wrong. But what it does mean is that I look at life differently. I try to stay in the solution, and if I make a mistake, tell me how to change it and make it better. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me transform within myself, rebuild relationships, learn how to live in today, connect in with my God of my understanding, who I choose to call God in a way I never dreamed possible, that continues to get better. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have taught, you know, transformed a girl that was dying from alcoholism into a person that can be of service to others and God's kids. You know, I can share my life and carry this deal everywhere I go. The traditions and the concepts are really powerful and active in my life. I go through those with the girls I sponsor. I am fortunate that I have some really beautiful women in my life. We have a big old sponsor tree. We get together. I have book studies with them. But through the years, some of the what I always like to share with people is you don't know what God's got planned for you. And that's something that I had to learn. And I also don't know who God's got planned for me. Because I don't have a good picker. I don't know who's good for me. I do not know. All I know is if I take the right actions, the people that are supposed to be in my life will be, and I'll land where I'm supposed to. And that's it. And that's really very simple. I'm good at doing the thinking and getting off the beam and say, well, maybe it'll work better over here. And then I get some information and go, well, once again, it's not. Let me get back on the beam, you know. But that's my alcoholism, you know, and that's just the truth of my condition. And if I get the truth of my condition, just like Dr. Bob did, he stays sober. We stay sober. You know, all I'm supposed to do is carry this message and work with others. And when I sponsor women, I'm preparing them to be a sponsor. And then they'll sponsor people, and they'll prepare people to be a sponsor. And that's what we do. And I got married again. I got married to Mr. Dennis Ellis, and we've had a great marriage. It'll be 11 years in May. It's the longest relationship I've ever been in, and it's amazing. And we have a beautiful home. We have 6 kids. We have 2 grandbabies. We have 4 dogs. I told you to do everything in quantity. I've had a lot of really amazing experiences in my recovery. I always wanted to teach school, and when we moved to Carolina, God called us there for 2 years and was able to sponsor people that had never been to AA before. I had amazing experiences. Actually, I had my Mayberry experience, I call it, and I say that with love because it was so different. But what that does for me, it keeps my mind open, and that, once again, we're all just here doing the deal and helping each other. And if I have that attitude, no matter where I go, that's all I need to do. And I got involved there and made some friends that we still talk to. And then we moved to another part of Carolina for about 7 months. But when I was in Graham, North Carolina, there was a principal in there. My home group, and you got to let people know what's going on with you for God to use other people to kind of show you the way, because he does use us. And if people don't know, how can you get the answer? So what happened was, he came to me one day and he said, "Christy, I'd really like you to teach at my school." And I was like, "What?" And you got to remember, I have no college and I have a felony on my record. And he said, "I want you to do that." And he said, "But there's only one thing, you got to drive a school bus." And I was like, "Okay." Because you guys taught me, when I get an opportunity, there might be a little piece I might not want to do, but it ain't all about me. It's about doing the work, you know. And that I really believe that God says, you know, "Christy, you said you wanted that. Well, how willing are you? How willing are you to do that?" And I really think that that happens sometimes. It's not supposed to be easy. I wanted to be in the world. He gives me a life, and I have regular problems just like anybody else. Long and the short of it is that I did get to teach school. I got to live a dream. And we did it while I was living there. I drove a school bus every morning with people's children. What a gift. Every morning at the cows, 6:30 in the morning, it's a rural area, beautiful. And I'm driving these kids. And I'm teaching these kids how to read, kids that needed extra. I love to read, and I like helping people that need extra. God was already taking me back to what I love. See, that's what happens here. We get restored and we get connected in with our gifts. We don't know what they are. We don't know how he's going to use us. We don't know when. But we just need to keep doing it, trudging, doing. You know, that corny thing you think, "Don't quit before the miracle," isn't corny. It really does work. It is truth. So the bottom line is that I got to do something that I would have sold myself short of if I hadn't been willing to take the actions. And one day my alcoholism is running its mouth in my head, and I'm saying, "What the heck am I doing sitting here?" That happens many times, because I don't think I'm qualified to be doing what I'm doing, and that's me, not him. And one of the students wrote on the board, "You're the best teacher I ever had." And I was like, and I went, "Okay, I'll shut up." Because it's me. It's always me. So today, we moved back, and I'm out of time, and I've had so many wonderful gifts, but let me tell you about today. You know, taking the right actions all through the years has brought me where I am today. I'm the sum total of what I do, you know. And again, if I mess up, I just say, "Show me different, and I do it better next time." You know, we don't have to be perfect here. Bottom line is, God's got great plans for every single one of us in here. We're just responsible for sharing this gift and walking together. We don't shoot our wounded. We're just one of many. Well, we don't. Come on, they're those people, and you know what I'm talking about. They're God's kids. You know, they're just not there yet. It's my responsibility to love them and join hands with them and share this gift with them, because we don't know when they're going to get it either. You know, I've had that experience with people. But today, I'm so excited. I work with the homeless. God took me right back to what I love in my heart. I get to spend my days helping the homeless and working with, we have two shelters and it's only soup kitchen in Richmond. I have the joy of connecting in with these folks and be a part of their lives. There, for the grace of God, go I, and go a lot of us. You know, but that's what he does. And what the program teaches me is, no matter where I am, I need to be of service. And he puts me in a position to be of service, I can promise you. He gives me lots of opportunities, and it's up to me to say yes. It's up to me to answer the phone when I don't feel like it. It's up for me to get up and go to that meeting that I told that newcomer I was going to go to, because they wanted me to be there so they wouldn't have to walk in alone. It's up to me to do those things that I say I'm going to do, because today the God in me sees the God in you. No more is it the sick in me sees the sick in you. It's the God in me sees the God in you. Because I am you and you are me. Thanks.